Arguments in Farmland Partners. We're here from the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chip Schoenberger on behalf of the appellant, Rhoda Fortuné. Your Honors, we're here today because the district court denied my client's motion to dismiss under a Texas statute known as the TCPA, which is often categorized in the broader category of anti-SLAPP statutes. The judge denied that motion without prejudice, simply as a way of deferring the issue until it could rule on a motion that the plaintiffs had brought to remand the case back to state court. The problem with that ruling is that under a plain reading of the Texas statute, it effectively barred my client's right to seek a remedy under that statute. And so this raises two issues that I'll focus my limited time on today, and I'll start with the one that the court ordered supplemental briefing on.
And it barred your ability to seek a remedy. Why?
Excuse me?
Barred your ability to seek a remedy. Why?
Because under the Texas statute, there is a strict 60-day filing deadline. The motion has to be filed within 60 days of service, and it is a waivable remedy. So in our case, the motion was filed on the 59th or 60th day. The court denied that motion, and under the plain reading of the statute, the statute doesn't contemplate a refiling of the motion. We would be barred under that plain language.
And are you talking about under a deemed denied idea, or what
are you? No, under the filing deadline. If the motion is denied and is effectively not in front of the court, then in order to revisit the motion, it would have to be refiled.
And you did refile it. Right?
That is correct.
All right, then. So how do you say you're denied a remedy? You are, in fact, seeking a remedy.
We did refile the motion because of the procedural posture of the case and because we didn't want to run the risk of waiving that right. But, again, under the plain reading of the statute and the cases, that motion has to be filed within 60 days. The refiling necessarily would occur outside of that time frame.
And you say the statute doesn't say what happens in that situation. So why are you insistent on the notion that you were barred from relief? I mean, that motion, by your own admission, is gone now. It just has no effect. And so if you were to refile, I mean, and the court contemplated, invited you to refile, and you did refile. So I mean, you're operating, if you're saying that you did it prophylactically, there's no reason to believe that you can't seek a remedy now.
Well, the court hasn't ruled on the issue, the statutory interpretation or the application of the 60-day deadline. Admittedly, prophylactically, we filed to make sure that we didn't waive that right. I believe under the plain language of the statute, and because the Texas courts do not contemplate this scenario, they have said that the only option when a TCPA motion is filed is granting or denying. There is no concept within that statutory framework for a denial without prejudice and a refiling. And I would point out that because of the timing components of the statute, allowing that to happen would defeat the entire purpose of the statute. The purpose of the statute, in part, is to constrain the time frame that it takes to resolve these motions. They're supposed to be resolved quickly. There is a filing deadline. There is a ruling deadline. There's an appeal deadline. Those are all very strict. And so to allow a denial without prejudice, an indefinite period of time, and now we're going on almost a year, would defeat the entire purpose of the statute.
All of this contemplates that the TCPA applies anyway.
Correct.
So, I mean, if it doesn't apply, then, well, let me ask a different way. If you have initially a question of whether you have jurisdiction, period, whether you have or whether we have jurisdiction over this matter, whether this is a final order, and whether it fits within the collateral order exception, and if we just look at what took place here, you have a decision. You have a decision which you that has been made without prejudice. Proceedings are still ongoing. You have, in fact, participated in those proceedings. You have, in fact, refiled your motion. Where is the finality in any of that?
It goes back to the original question of my answer to that, which is, yes, we physically refiled the motion. That does not mean that under the statutory scheme, that motion is proper or valid. It just means that we physically filed it. Now, it's a question of law.
Have you waived any ability to claim to the contrary? I mean, have you waived any ability to claim somehow or other that this the decision of the district court was final? By acting on the premise that it is not final. You have acted on that premise by, in fact, taking the district court up on its invitation to refile. So, I mean, you're before us saying, well, you know, this thing is final, and therefore we've been harmed, and we need to be able to appeal, while you're acting below as if it's not. And so isn't there a problem with that in terms of litigation conduct and the ability to create a waiver?
I don't see it as a waiver problem, Your Honor, because we did file the notice of appeal. We filed it within 30 days under the collateral order doctrine, and we sought that remedy
in that doctrine. Whether you are under that doctrine is the question, and whether what you've done is final, whether that order is a final order. The district court certainly doesn't view it as such.
That's correct, but it's a question of law that the district court has not determined.
Is the district court's ruling final as regards your instantaneous ability to obtain relief under the TCPA? I mean, this thing sort of feels like a qualified immunity interlocutory appeal kind of problem. If life goes on in the district court, you've lost the ability to have any teeth in the TCPA, which is, I think, what you're trying to assert.
That's exactly right, and that's the rationale under the Los Lobos case. Because the statutory provisions contemplate an immunity-like ability to avoid litigation and to accelerate resolution of the motion, by depriving us of that, forcing us to go back to the court and refile, go through that process, that defeats the entire purpose of the statute. That's the reason why the collateral order doctrine applies in this case. And the refiling, the taking of the appeal is our assertion of the right to seek that remedy in this court, because the ruling, I believe, under the plain reading of the statute, is final.
But in Los Lobos, the district court actually made a decision whether the TCPA applied or not.
Correct.
And in some sense, it made that threshold determination. There's been no threshold determination made here. This district court denied it simply to conduct some discovery, which later turned out not to be something that was going to take place. But that's the reason. So this is not the same as Los Lobos in that situation, is it?
It's not in that situation, but I think the practical effect is the same, because if we are precluded, despite the fact that we did refile the motion prophylactically, if as a matter of law we are precluded from having that motion heard because of the plain language of the statute, then it is final.
Well, let me
And I'm sorry to interrupt.
Please,
if I can just
ahead.
Finish my
sure,
thought.
Sure, of course.
As far as the Los Lobos decision goes, because this is a final decision and we asserted our right, that is the predicate of the conclusiveness point or element of collateral order jurisdiction. There are other issues, the three other stages of that as well. And as Judge Briscoe pointed out, the effectively unreviewable piece of it is really, I think, indistinguishable from Los Lobos on the other two issues. Because we have the separate issue of what was the reason for the court having done this, and we think that is erroneous. The court did not address the merits of the TCPA motion, although, just as an aside, it has now indicated in subsequent proceedings that are not in the appendix materials, but they're in the district court record, the court has indicated that it believes that the TCPA does not apply in federal court.
Has that been supplemented? Do we have that in our record? Telling us now?
It was a post-appeal and post-briefing material, so it's not in the appendix materials. It is in the district court record, which the court has access to. I'm happy to supplement if it's necessary.
So the district court, did it enter a decision then?
Not a decision on the TCPA motion. The court denied our motion to stay pending appeal, which we filed because all of these issues are currently before your honors, and we believe that divested the trial court of jurisdiction to continue on with rulings in this manner. But because in the context of denying the motion to stay, the court indicated it believed that the TCPA did not apply in federal court. However, the TCPA motion, the refiled one, is still pending, and the court has not issued a ruling on that. It has not made a definitive
decision. So, long story short, the district court has not, at this point, decisively ruled on the application of the TCPA.
Correct.
That is, that it does or does not apply.
Correct.
Well, to that point, it is a different posture than Los Lobos, and it creates, sure, it seems to me, a sort of tricky situation, because it seems to me the whole predicate of your satisfaction of collateral order doctrine is the fact that the TCPA applies. We don't have a ruling on whether the TCPA applies one way or the other, and which is not the situation in Los Lobos. And because of that situation, is it the case, is it your belief or position that we have to make that initial threshold determination ourselves in order for you to satisfy the collateral order doctrine?
Not the determination of the, well, no. I think conclusivity exists because of the statutory framework and the 60-day filing deadline.
Well, that's a TCPA matter. So I'm asking, but do we have to say here whether the TCPA applies in order to determine that you satisfy the collateral order doctrine? If we push the TCPA aside and view that as an entirely discrete issue, do you satisfy the collateral order doctrine?
Yes, I think we do.
And why?
Because of the refiling limit. Now, if the court...
TCPA matter, right?
Sorry?
It's a TCPA matter. The point I'm making is can we divorce your argument for collateral order satisfaction from the TCPA? The refiling issue is a TCPA creature. So the question is, because you've refiled the motion, mm-hmm, you're just saying that you don't think it's effective under the TCPA. So the question is, could we decide that you satisfy the collateral order doctrine apart from the TCPA and its filing requirements?
No, I don't think you can.
Okay.
So move on to the point that was raised about the TCPA's application in federal court. We have a circuit split on this issue, a high-level one with regard to anti-SLAPP statutes and their application in federal court, although all the circuits have dealt with different specific anti-SLAPP statutes. But the main difference between those cases, like the First Circuit's decision in Godin and the Fifth Circuit's decision in Clocky, those two schools of thought, is in their the manner in which they approach and address the eerie question of what happens when a state law appears to overlap with a federal rule. And everyone agrees that that's a three-step analysis. One, we look at whether or not the state law is substantive. Two, if it is, we look at whether it directly conflicts with a federal rule. And three, if it does, we look at whether the federal rule is valid. Now, I am not here today arguing that any federal rule is invalid. The issue and where the cases diverge is on the first two steps. And that's where we look to the controlling concurrence in Shady Grove. In that concurrence, Justice Stevens recognized that state laws, even though they may function in a procedural manner, can operate to define a state substantive law. And that's exactly what we have with the TCPA on really two levels. The statute creates a class of cases, a narrow class of cases to which are subject to dismissal under its provisions. And those provisions are substantive. We have a burden-shifting framework. We have a standard for evaluating the plaintiff's burden under that shifting framework. We have a damages component that includes attorney's fees. And then we have the timing components, which, to Your Honor's point, create an immunity-like right to accelerate resolution of those claims and avoid protracted litigation.
Normally I would stop you here, but I think this matter requires a little more argument time than you all have asked for. I will give both sides 5 additional minutes. You can continue your argument.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. So when that's the case, when you have a substantive state law, we move on to the second step, and that's the conflict step. And Shady Grove, the concurrence, also directs us on that. And it says that we must endeavor to see if there is a way to reasonably interpret the federal rule so as to avoid a conflict and allow the state substantive law and the federal rule to operate side by side if we can. And we have an example of that in Walker, which predates Shady Grove but foreshadows that framework. And in that case, the court looked at Rule 3, which says a lawsuit commences upon filing. It compared that to a state statute that said a lawsuit commences upon service of process for statute of limitations purposes. And the Supreme Court harmonized those by looking at the intent of Rule 3 and saying that Rule 3 was never intended to control limitations periods, even though on their face they appear to be at odds with each other. So now compare that with Shady Grove, where you had an unavoidable direct conflict between Rule 23, which granted an affirmative right to maintain a class action if you met the requirements of that rule, and a state rule that limited that right. That was an unavoidable conflict, and even Justice Stevens, under his framework, found as such. So the anti-SLAPP statutes that we're dealing with here, as a general category, they look at Rules 12 and 56. And the First Circuit in Godin held that when you look at the intent of the rules, they don't answer the same question. They don't serve the same purpose. Rule 12 and Rule 56 don't attempt to address the legislative concerns that statutes like the TCPA have with regard to free speech rights and protecting those rights. They function differently. They have different standards that they're reviewed under, and they can coexist under this Shady Grove and Walker and even Gasparini type of framework. So the way that the Clocky line of cases treat this strays from that framework, because it does exactly what Justice Stevens cautioned against. It takes a narrow approach to determining, first of all, step one, whether or not the statute is substantive or procedural. And essentially, they say that if the statute looks to other sources of law to determine the elements of the plaintiff's underlying claim, then it has to be procedural. It can't be substantive. That is not what Justice Stevens' framework in Shady Grove proposes. It doesn't engage in the recognition of substantive rights that are wrapped up in procedural mechanisms. Second, that line of cases takes a presumptive view of Rule 56 and Rule 12, and it presumes a sort of preemptive occupy the field type of approach, and says essentially anything that adds to the federal rules is in direct conflict with it. And that is not in the spirit of Walker and Gasparini and the other cases that engaged in the attempt to harmonize and allow the state rule, the state substantive law, and the federal law to operate together. I would like to reserve my last 1 minute for rebuttal, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning.
May it please the court. The appellant, Rhoda Fortuné, who I will refer to as RF, I find that easier to say, appeals from an order that did not conclusively determine anything. More specifically, the district court's order did not resolve whether the applicable choice of law principles permit or require application of the TCPA, which is a gating issue before you'd even get to the TCPA. The district court also didn't resolve whether the TCPA can apply in federal court. The district court also did not resolve whether the TCPA would apply in this case, notwithstanding its exemption for commercial speech. The district court's order also did not resolve whether the TCPA would require dismissal of the defamation and disparagement claims. And the district court's order also did not resolve conclusively whether what RF characterizes as the derivative claims would also be subject to dismissal. And we know that the district court did not conclusively determine those questions.
Yes, but to the conversation that was going on with opposing counsel, that puts opposing counsel and that puts RF in a very difficult situation, because if the district court decides not to make an initial threshold determination as to whether the TCPA applies, then the benefit that they would get from the TCPA evaporates. The notion, to analogize this to the qualified immunity context, they have a right, if the TCPA applies, to have a quick, prompt determination of this action, and they would lose that right. And so it seems to me that there is a problem that we're going to have to come to grips with as to what to do in a situation like this where the district court essentially punts, on a threshold matter which affects conceivably the rights of RF. What do we do in that situation? Because the reality is somebody's going to have to decide that issue as to whether TCPA applies, because otherwise they don't have an opportunity to have that right vindicated one way or the other.
Your Honor, I disagree with respect on multiple grounds. The first one being, why did the district court do what it did? District court deferred briefly consideration of the motions, and not just the TCPA, other substantive motions that were pending, to consider its predicate issue of federal subject matter jurisdiction. There was a motion to remand pending. There were served anonymous co-defendants who hadn't consented. The district court wanted to assure itself that it had subject matter jurisdiction, which is obviously, I think, logically a predicate issue. Far before you reach the issue of whether it should rule on the TCPA, the district court has to know whether it has jurisdiction.
It didn't have to deny the motion. And that's the point is, by denying the motion, it has created this situation. Yes, I'm familiar with the procedural history. I know what you're talking about. I know what it was trying to do. The point is, there is an effect that derives from what it was trying to do if the TCPA applies. And because it didn't do a up and down as we had in Los Lobos, it just punted. It didn't do anything.
Your Honor, I think the technical terminology for what the district court did, denial without prejudice, inviting RF to refile, which he did, is akin to the stays, for example, temporary stays of proceedings that this court has routinely held do not support an appeal under the collateral order doctrine, or could the district court simply have held these motions in abeyance? And the question is whether the district court's ability to pragmatically manage its own docket, should be supervised in this manner where there's a suggestion that it was improper, where the TCPA itself says in section 27.003, the court may extend the time to file a motion under this section. So there is no firm rule that the court could not extend the time. And I believe that's what the court was trying to do, trying to basically reset the clocks. Also, the notion that there's some significant loss here based on the timing, the delay that has been incurred is RF's own fault. This is a procedurally odd case. At that hearing in December, the district court made very clear that it wanted to consider its own jurisdiction, would do so promptly, and then the motions that had been denied without prejudice could be refiled. RF appeals. At the next hearing, the district court made clear that it believed it still had jurisdiction, but RF's counsel said no, the appeal automatically divested the district court of jurisdiction. And it's clear on the record the district court thought this created yet another jurisdictional issue. Finally, RF had not yet moved to reconsider the state court order on substituted service. District court effectively had to prod RF to do so at a hearing. Once RF did so, the district court could rule on the motion to remand. And the perversity here is that the proceedings that are ongoing in the district court thus far have benefited RF. The motion to remand was denied. And frankly, I think you should be a little bit skeptical of the claim of harm where there are two key issues on which RF has taken a firm position and then simply reversed course despite imposing burdens on this court, the district court, and my client. RF takes a firm position that the TCPA has been conclusively determined, then refiles the motion. Entirely inconsistent. RF moves for a stay before this court, claiming irreparable harm. This court denies. RF goes to the district court, seeks a stay. The district court denies. RF does not come back to this court to seek a stay. Instead, is currently engaging in litigation, going forward with discovery. So some of these claims about the harms, they've chosen not to pursue a stay as far as they can.
Well, don't you get to the point in some of this that they had better act or they would have waived their rights?
Not
what that is, for instance, the appeal itself. If in fact, their point is, and as I understand it, that the TCPA gives them rights and it's a right to have things expeditiously decided, and they are not being given that benefit, and the district courts initially prohibited that benefit. So they appeal it. I mean, that's what happens.
The various timelines under the TCPA had not yet run at the time of the appeal. The TCPA provides for extension, not merely of the time to file, but if the court is busy, it can also extend the time for a hearing. So the TCPA itself contemplates that there will be extensions of time.
Extensions of time to file, but that doesn't catch the procedural situation we're in here, because they didn't need an extension of the time to file. They filed within the 60 days. It was denied. So the question then is what happens after that? Because they have filed one motion. That motion was denied. So this isn't it depends on how clever you want to be, but it doesn't on its face look like an extension when they file a second motion. So this says, so they're not, I mean, so arguably they have lost. I mean, I don't want to explore right now, but what would be the impact if they had held that motion in abeyance? But the court didn't do that. It denied it. And so, and if this statute applies, arguably that has consequences that are harmful to them.
Your Honor,
tell me why I'm wrong, what I'm missing here. But this is the, do you perceive this too? How would an extension help them in this situation?
Your Honor, my point was that the TCPA permits the district court proceedings to take more time given the circumstances present in the district court.
I got it, but how would it help them that the district court has now denied the motion? What would be the vehicle under the statute that could remedy the harm if that denial is final? Is it final?
It is not final, Your
Honor. Under the statute, would it be final?
No, Your Honor.
Why?
The statute does not expressly say that a district court, a federal district court, in assessing its jurisdiction, cannot reset the clock by denying without prejudice to refile. It simply does not address this situation.
The statute applies in federal court in a diversity situation. We're following this, and diversity implies we're going to be following the rule as it would in state court. And so if this happened in state court under the TCPA, the court denied this motion because they wanted to do some housekeeping thing or wanted to work out whether it had jurisdiction over this matter, whatever, would that be final is my point.
Your Honor, I don't think the Texas courts have addressed whether a denial without prejudice as opposed to
that's the
a
question
denial.
I'm asking you. Have you looked into that? Do you know the answer to that question?
Your Honor, I do not believe the Texas courts have addressed that issue, in part because of the flexibility provided by the statute. And I think there's a false premise here. Absent this appeal, it's entirely possible the district court would have ruled on the refiled TCPA motion within the timelines provided by the TCPA itself.
Yes, and then there well could have been an argument by you that they couldn't do it. Once the court had filed, said the TCPA applies, and then they refile their motion, and you say, well, you know, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I look at the TCPA. It doesn't contemplate that they can do this. They can't do this. I know you're trying to do good by well by them, but you can't do it. Why couldn't that argument be made?
Your Honor, that argument could be made, and it's entirely contrary, I think, to the purposes underlying the collateral order doctrine that this court has repeatedly recognized, which is you should not have the same issues proceeding before two courts. That obviously does not promote judicial economy. It's also somewhat perverse to have motions pending before the district court that would moot this appeal, never requiring any consideration of the TCPA because there's a separately filed motion to dismiss under 12b-6. Accordingly, district court could dismiss for failure to state a claim, and the TCPA issues would never arise. Similarly, the district court could determine under choice of law principles that the TCPA doesn't apply, and then we'd have a fight about choice of law that wouldn't necessarily implicate the question of whether the TCPA can even apply in federal court. And that's why I think it's so important in this court's jurisprudence to look at the specific question. The cases focus in the collateral order assessment on what is the specific issue that was denied, conclusively resolved. Because if you don't know, you can't say whether it's tied up in the merits. Here, for example, there is no way to say that the issue of whether the TCPA can apply in federal court is the issue on the table.
And that's the point. Why can't we say that? Because the whole predicate of their argument of harm, the whole predicate of their argument of it being conclusive, is that the TCPA applies. And so to that point, if you could give me the benefit of anything that you have found of an analogous situation, because this situation is, I think, somewhat unique, because the point is that, and I heard at least opposing counsel say, that in order to really do justice to the collateral order determination, we have to look at whether the TCPA applies, because it colors the question of whether it's conclusive or not.
Your Honor, if we're going to focus on what is the issue that was conclusively resolved that would permit this court to exercise jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine, you would need to know what is the basis for the district court's denial of TCPA rights here. And that denial, assuming there was one, I don't believe there was one, given the district court's comments, but that denial, if there were one, could have been based on a determination that the TCPA does not apply here based on the commercial exemption, given the trading activity and basically the services and monetary compensation involved. That would be enmeshed with the facts on the merits and not a distinct legal issue.
Absolutely.
Entirely abstracted.
That's an easy case. That's not this case.
That's right, Your Honor. Because we don't know, that's why the collateral order doctrine does not apply. In fact, if we don't know what the precise question at issue is, the collateral order doctrine does not permit appeal for a variety of reasons. Similarly, the notion that there is no relief where they have refiled, you've pointed out the loss of time. I think this court has many cases making clear that some loss of time is not some sort of irreparable harm. And the suggestion that there's some binary choice between resolution now and trial doesn't make sense here for purposes of the third prong of the collateral order doctrine because the TCPA motion is refiled. If they had the courage of their convictions and had not refiled and just simply taken the position that that's it, they're out of time, we'd be in a different situation, I think.
Lawyers do prophylactic stuff. This isn't about courage. This is about trying to protect your client. So, I mean, that's not what we're talking about here. They made a decision to prophylactically file this motion because they didn't know how this thing was going to play out. I'm pretty sure there are a good number of lawyers who'd be sitting on that end of the table who would have done exactly the same thing.
I understand, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting you wouldn't, but they've eliminated the basis for claiming that they cannot refile.
Well, if they're refiling and they don't know what effect it has, that's the whole point. Sure, they can refile. If they can refile and it will be null and void, you know, it's void because of what has taken place before. Let me just, there's something you said that I do want to explore, and this is the question of, you know, the collateral order doctrine goes to categories of cases. You know, not individual cases. And so the question would be here, what happens when we can't figure out what category of case this is? And I take it your answer is, given any ambiguity as to what the category of case is, the onus is upon them to define it clearly enough so that we can find that it is subject to the collateral order doctrine?
Your Honor, I actually think that the category of case is not the category of case considered in Los Lobos. A definitive denial of an argument that a specific anti-SLAPP statute applies in federal court.
It's not that. I'm asking if we can't define what the category of case, what is the category of case?
And I think the category of case is denial without prejudice, or you could look at this court's authority regarding stays. There's authority from this court that brief stays tend not to permit appeal under the collateral order doctrine because temporary stays, not ones that effectively resolve a case, the harm is limited and it doesn't support the finality interests and judicial economy and all the considerations that are baked into the collateral order doctrine.
But it's not just a denial without prejudice. It's a denial without prejudice that may have the effect that triggers the SLAPP statute. And so the question is how much do you particularize whatever category you're talking about for purposes of the collateral order doctrine? I mean, you can abstract things to the point where, you know, obviously they have one result or not another. I mean,
Your Honor, with different. Pardon me.
No, pardon me.
With respect, I think a better category would be denial without prejudice for the district court's consideration of its subject matter jurisdiction. Moving on to the TCPA arguments, I wanted to make two clarifications. The first one is, as the court, I think, noted, the district court has not ruled on the TCPA motion, and instead, in denying a stay, merely cited the Fifth Circuit's decision in, I'm not sure if it's Clock or Clocky, I'm going to say Clock, the Fifth Circuit's decision in Clock and this court's decision in Los Lobos in denying the stay, but didn't indicate that it was denying the TCPA motion. And I disagree with the framing of the analysis under Shady Grove that was presented as made clear in Your Honor's Westlake decision. The first step is not a question of whether or not the state law is substance or procedure. That would answer the analysis. The first step is the consideration of whether there is a federal rule that answers the question, whether there is direct collision with the federal rule. And I think the result here would be the same under any of the analyses presented in the, what I'll call the majority in Shady Grove, or Justice Stevens' concurrence. Because at the end of the day, the TCPA is a procedural statute. If you look at the Lipsky case from the Texas Supreme Court, it makes clear that these are procedural mechanisms that do not change the burden of proof at trial. They don't change the outcome. They may change some timing.
Can we really rely on our ruling in Los Lobos, or should we rely on it, or do we look at Clocky's analysis? And my point here is we have two lines of cases where varying circuits have applied either the Scalia view of Shady Grove or the Stevens view. Clocky applies Scalia. We apply, historically and in Los Lobos, Stevens. So can we look at Clocky and say, oh, that's good, it answers our question, when we have controlling law in this circuit where we follow Stevens' concurrence?
That's why I pointed out, Your Honor, that I believe the result remains the same under the Stevens concurrence because, as Clocky finds in analyzing the TCPA, that is a procedural statute. So you don't run into the complications of any possibility of the...
You have to walk through a lot more things than they walk through in Clocky to get to that conclusion.
Yes, you do, Your Honor.
Right.
But I still think Clocky has squarely addressed that issue. And I'm also not sure that we really have a circuit split so much as pre-Shady Grove law from the Ninth Circuit that two judges from the Ninth Circuit have made clear they'd like to overturn. That was Judge Kaczynski and Paez in the Trump University case. And then we have the First Circuit, but other than that, we have been looking at a consistent set of rulings based on then-judge, now-Justice Kavanaugh's ruling in Abbas, and the Carbone CNN in the 11th Circuit, and now the Fifth Circuit. And so the law is moving that way, but I do still believe that we have a direct collision here, even under the Stevens concurrence view, because, as is made clear in a variety of cases, there are not bare minimum pleading requirements expressed in the federal rules. Those are instead a comprehensive set of requirements, and they can't coexist.
What about the fact that these statutes on their face are very different? That is, the anti-SLAPP statutes. You look at the Los Lobos, New Mexico statute, and you look at the Texas statute, they are very different.
I agree that they're different.
So you can say maybe, you know, Los Lobos look procedural. When we really get into the weeds of the Texas statute, it's starting to look substantive.
With respect, I disagree, Your Honor, and that's what Clocky looked at, that it's not substantive. In fact, it's entirely procedural, just like pleading standards generally are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I just have two quick points with my 57 seconds. As far as the category of cases go, to Your Honor's question, I think it is. The category of cases is the denial without prejudice of a motion that has a statutory bar to refiling. And on a related point...
Do you have a case that deals with such a situation?
No. Texas has not contemplated it because the statute doesn't contemplate it. And related to that... My opponent pointed out that there is a provision in the TCPA that says the court can extend the time to file. That isn't the case here. That's not what happened. It was filed. But if Your Honors were to consider that to be, you know, a malleable concept, and that refiling and extending the filing date, there's really no meaningful difference there other than the prolonging of the litigation, which defeats the purpose of the statute. If the court were to find that we can file and it's not barred by the statute, then we're back in front of the district court, and we know from what the district court has said that it's going to deny that motion on the Clocky, Shady Grove basis. And so, therefore, I think the court would be perfectly within its authority to just address that issue now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. Case is submitted. Our last case for oral argument this morning is LK.